Morning, everyone. Thanks so much for coming to this important session at 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and for your commitment to being here. It probably is very difficult after a night in Paris, and I hope you had a lovely night in Paris last night. My name is Javed Sayed. I work at Treatment Action Group in New York. And Treatment Action Group is an organization that came out of AIDS activism that now has been working on TB-HIV, and our real mission is to make sure that people who live with the diseases have access to the appropriate services, and that include, of course, diagnostics, vaccines, and care, and treatment and care. And so part of our mission is then to include the voices that are of people affected by the disease in decision-making, in different levels of decision-making. And so this panel is an example of some of the work that we've been doing.
Hi, good morning. My name's Dorothy Namtamba, and I work with the International Community of Women Living with HIV and AIDS in the East African region. And ICW has partnered with Treatment Action Group to build to empower the community activists to be able to prioritize TB and TB-HIV issues into their advocacy work. And these are just examples of the kind of work that the community activists are doing. Okay.
And so when we were putting together this panel, we were interested in not only having the voices of communities who are living with the diseases, but and activists who are working from civil society, but also people who are working in institutions that have seen the benefit of TB-HIV activism. And so part of our structuring the panel was also to make sure that we aren't only speaking to the converted. And so I would love to see if there is anyone here from a national TB or AIDS program. I know that there's at least one person from a national TV program from South Africa. Welcome. Thanks for being here. Mm-hmm. So part of our hope is also to make sure that as community empowerment has been now part of the TB control strategy, you know, one of our hopes is to demystify what community empowerment means and hopefully learn from you as well about what this could look like in your context. One request that's been made just logistically is that whenever we speak, we should speak in the mic because it's being recorded. And so if we speak outside, we won't be able to hear it on the Kaiser network potentially.
Okay. Before Javed introduces our speakers, I just want to make a small note that in 2006, the World Health Organization expanded the TB control strategy from being only focused on the dots and included the TB-HIV issues and also issues around community empowerment. But however, we still see that NTP program managers are still grappling with the meaning of community engagement, and primarily see that the role of communities as at times dots workers. The panel that we are about to hear from and the panel that Javed is about to introduce to us will broaden. We hope that it will be able to broaden our understanding of what community empowerment means, and because they'll be sharing with us the examples of the work that they've been able to do to contribute to the health system strengthening in their countries and in their work that they've been able to do.
So with that, I wanted to bring up the first speaker, Alistair Reed, who comes from UNAIDS. He's the TB-HIV advisor to UNAIDS. He's worked in South Africa as well as the inner city hospitals in London, and it's a pleasure to introduce him.
Thanks very much, Javed and Dorothy, for organizing this session and inviting me to speak. I was expecting to speak third, and I did have a good night out in Paris last night, so apologies if it's perhaps not as slick as it should be. I was asked to talk about TB-HIV policy and monitoring and advocacy from an HIV institutional perspective. But I've actually expanded that a little bit to look at the history of civil society engagement within the major institutions in HIV and TB, and to give a little bit of history of activism in TB and HIV. So a little bit of history. Some of the major international policy frameworks and commitments to addressing TB in people living with HIV, and the role the communities have played in that, how these are being these global commitments are being translated into local action through the involvement of civil society. And also a little bit about how engaging civil society in monitoring and evaluation of national TB-HIV activities has contributed. And I think we'll hear more about that from some of the other speakers later. So I'll just touch on that lightly. First off, I think it's always useful to get a little bit of clarity about what we're talking about here in terms of the difference between advocacy, social mobilization, and communication. Advocacy, these are two definitions I quite like of advocacy, although there are as many definitions of advocacy as there are activists. But these are simple ones. The second one, the UNAIDS one, a strategic process, really gives this idea that advocacy is a long-term thing. It's a process of activities that aim to target influential people. Essentially getting influential people to do what you want them to do. And these pictures here are from, many of you will have seen the first major demonstration at a global tuberculosis meeting in Cape Town, South Africa, organized by the Treatment Action Campaign. And I'm sure many of you recognize Zaki Ahmed there, who really is one of the leaders in HIV activism and more lately in TB-HIV activism. Now compare that high-level or advocacy, which is really aimed at special interest groups trying to get influential people to do what they want them to do. Communication is more particularly aimed at individuals in the general population or specific segments of society, maybe women, maybe people living with HIV, maybe workers. The idea is to raise their awareness of certain issues and hopefully bring about behavior change. It might be about smoking. It might be about HIV prevention. And then finally, compare that with community mobilization, which is generally done for communities and by communities, either individuals or organizations. And it's essentially about building community capacity to be able to prioritize their own needs and actually to take action. So I just thought that was a useful way of starting. We hear about advocacy, communication, social mobilization all the time, and I for one, find it all a little bit confusing, and I think useful to get it clear. And one document that some of you may not be aware of on the WHO website, this was done in partnership with the Futures Group, is a training manual. There's both a trainer's manual and a participant's manual, which is about networking for policy change, and it's specifically focused around TB-HIV advocacy. But some of the principles on advocacy can be adapted to any situation, and I find it very useful. So what about activism and civil society engagement in HIV? Well, I think the idea, the HIV community were one of the first to really endorse the idea of involvement of affected people and affected communities. And I'm sure many of you have heard of the GIPA principle, or greater involvement of people living with HIV/AIDS. And the theory behind it is that people living with HIV obviously understand their situation better than anyone else. They are best placed to provide support and education to each other, and best placed to represent their needs in policy decision-making processes. This idea was first sort of really talked about back in 1983 at a national AIDS conference in the US, and was then formally adopted at the Paris AIDS Summit in 1994. At that time, 42 countries declared GEPA as critical to the national AIDS response. And I think now it's pretty much accepted as an essential component of the global HIV response. And engagement and involvement doesn't just mean the tokenistic wheeling out a person living with HIV at the beginning of the National AIDS Conference, but although those roles are extremely important in putting a face, a human face, onto a condition, about reducing stigma, etc. But it's much more than that. It's actually meaningfully engaging them in policy discourse and in decision-making processes, and in building capacity, their capacity to be able to support their peers. Now, compare that a little more to the TB situation. Now, what we perhaps forget is that in the pre-antibiotic era, the Belle Epoque in Europe and the Victorian era in the UK, for example, there really was a very strong civil society movement around tuberculosis. There was no treatment. It was a fatal disease. It affected anyone, much in the same way as HIV did before we had antiretrovirals. So there were many, many societies around the world that were trying to mobilize civil society to increase funding for tuberculosis, to try and get people to sanatoria and prevent what was then an untreatable condition. But with the advent of antibiotics in the 40s and 50s, and as tuberculosis then became very medicalized, that activism and advocacy kind of disappeared. And there's perhaps a lesson in there for the HIV world that, and there's signs of this happening in the US, where now that there is treatment available, people no longer see HIV as a risk. They don't really care so much about it. They're not worried about it. And that activism and advocacy is kind of dying down. So, that's something to keep in mind. And then really advocacy and activism in the TB world went quiet for a long time. The DOT strategy, when it was introduced back in 93, didn't mention community involvement at all. Following that, the WHO had community TB care project, which was first sort of published in 1999. But that wasn't really community involvement. That was about communities being providers of TB care, and didn't really address capacity building, advocacy, activism within that concept. The first real sort of idea as communities, as partners, and I'm perhaps being unfair here to say that it's only happened in 2000, but if you look at documents, etc., on the website, these are the sort of time periods where it's endorsed. And it wasn't until the Amsterdam Declaration in 2000 that the idea of partnership with communities was involved in international policy discourse around TB. Around about the same time, there was involvement. I think it was 2002 or 2003 that there was a community representative first introduced onto the WHO Strategic and Technical Advisory Group. This is a body of experts that advises on the strategic and policy direction of WHO. So it wasn't until around 2002, 2003 that civil society was engaged in that. That was Mark Harrington, who I'm sure many of you know from Treatment Action Group, who really has been pivotal in driving WHO Stop TB and the partnership to recognize the importance of partnering with the community. Having said that, most of the Stop TB partnership working groups have had civil society representatives on them from the outset. And I think the DOTS Expansion Working Group was established around 2000, 2001. And all the working groups up until then have had civil society representatives on them. But it wasn't until 2005 that there was actually an advocacy communication and social mobilization working group established in TB. The global plan to stop TB, the second global plan to stop TB, actually fully endorsed the meaningful involvement of patients and affected communities. And that was also the first time that we see community empowerment endorsed in the WHO, well, the global strategy, the Stop TB strategy. This is the revised version of the DOT strategy that recognises that special issues such as TB, HIV and drug resistance need to be included, but also one of the core elements is meaningful engagement with civil societies. And again, it was not until 2006 that there was any mention or reporting on community involvement activities in the WHO Global TB Control Report. So really, I think you can see that the TB world was much slower to use the tools of advocacy and community engagement to move its agenda forward. And I think this slide is really quite telling. If you consider the world of HIV that really built very quickly a very strong, targeted, motivated, active civil society group, people like ACT UP, who were protesting and demanding better services, better diagnosis, better treatment, etc., they have moved much faster. You know, HIV has only been around for 25 years. We have a rapid finger prick test that gives you an accurate HIV test result in minutes. You can do it at home. We have dozens of new drugs. It's very telling that the research budget for HIV is $3 billion for the National Institute of Health, Institutes for Health in the US alone, and globally is probably around $8 billion a year. And compare that to TB, it's been around for thousands of years. Our diagnostic test is pretty rubbish. Our drugs are not much better. Well, they're effective, but we haven't had any new ones. There are a few in the pipeline, but we're still a long way from having dozens of new drugs like HIV. And the global research budget is a tiny fraction of that for HIV. So I'm not saying that's the whole reason behind it, but advocacy, community engagement, building activism has been a key part of the success of HIV. So where can and where have communities been involved in moving the TB agenda forward? The Global Plan to Stop TB, this is the Stop TB Partnership's plan for the world to reach the Millennium Development Goals for TB. And I was involved in, as were many others, in developing the TB-HIV component of the global plan. So we sat down and we carefully worked out what could be done and what should be done and how fast we would scale up. And we were being realistic but optimistic was, the scenario that was created. And, you know, we were saying, well, you know, we know what we've got and it's not really good, so we can't be too ambitious because we simply won't get there. But we were trying to do with what we had, we were trying to do the best. But quite rightly, civil society groups turned around to us, and I think it was in Paris about 2 years ago, actually. Yeah, it was Versailles, that's right. They simply said, we refuse the scale-up plan. We have to be in, you know, you can't say you're going for universal access and then not do it, which was quite right, of course. And so I was going to say we, but it wasn't. It was I had to go away and redo all the numbers very quickly overnight and come back the next day with this revised schedule, which was accepted. And actually, to many of our surprise, we heard at the beginning of the week that these targets are being reached in Africa. Not all of them, but many of them are being reached. So that this action was quite right. Nobody was saying, we don't want to work too hard, let's just keep it slow. It was really just trying to be realistic. But what we learned from things like 3x5, the WHO HIV initiative, is that you can be ambitious. If you set high targets and drive and get everybody behind that, they can be achieved a little bit later than expected, but they can be achieved. So I think that was a very strong lesson that we learned, that we have to be a little bit more ambitious, even though we think our what we can achieve is limited. UNGAS is the UN General Assembly Special Session on HIV, and the 2006 Special Session, I think, was the first to have shadow reporting. And the idea was, all countries are expected to submit a report to UNGAS on a set of key indicators. But a number of civil society organizations said, we don't believe the figures that our country are submitting. They're saying that everybody's getting access to HIV treatment, but we know that's not the case. So a number of groups actually got together and said, okay, let's do a shadow report that highlights where the gaps are. And there were 40 of these reports in 2006. In 2009, there were only nine. 2008, rather, there were only nine. Now, that looks like there's something wrong there. But actually what happened was that many countries saw these shadow reports and thought, they're right. And what they've moved to in subsequent years is actually joint reporting, where rather than having a government UNGAS report and a civil society report, that the two come together and look at the data together and discuss where the gaps are and put in a joint report. And these have been extremely powerful in influencing country activities, engaging civil society much more in the policy process. And it was back in 2006 that Treatment Action Group in New York, Javid and Claire and Mark and others, and OSI, lobbied a number of the country missions in New York to include TB language in the UNGAS declaration. Up until then, UNGAS very much only focused on HIV, even though TB, as we know, is one of the most important causes of illness and death. So they actually got this paragraph of language. It's slightly abbreviated, but this, just that paragraph of language, made a big difference. It gave a lot of civil society groups and a lot of technical agency, WHO, for example, was able to go to the HIV community, the WHO TB department was able to go to the HIV community and say, look, now this is endorsed in UNGAS. This is the political declaration coming out of UNGAS is saying we've got to work together on TB and amongst people living with HIV. So that helped to move the policy discourse along at the highest level, but it also gave civil society activists at country level the opportunity to go to their HIV program managers and say, look, in the UNGAS it says that we're going to do much more. We've got to be in line with the global plan to stop TB. We've got to do much more to try and get better drugs, better diagnostics, etc. And again, although it seemed, one small paragraph and one political declaration somewhere, it doesn't seem like much. It really does help to get the ball rolling. And then going to the organization I work for, UNAIDS really had done very little in the world of tuberculosis. And in fact, when I joined in two years ago, I was the first tuberculosis person ever to work in UNAIDS. And I still am the only tuberculosis person in UNAIDS, unfortunately. But hopefully that will change. And the Program Coordinating Board is the governing body of UNAIDS, and they back in 2007 the NGO delegation raised the issue of tuberculosis falling on from the using the political declaration as the backup. Said that we really, the Program Coordinating Board, the PCB, has to start talking about tuberculosis and why it's an issue for people living with HIV, especially in light of the XDR outbreak in South Africa. And so they have a thematic session for each PCB, and this is a one day where they discuss an issue outside the formal workings of the PCB. They discuss an important issue, and they decided that in 2008 this thematic session would be on tuberculosis. So we had a one day session where all the PCB members attend. These are high level ministers of health, heads of agencies that come together to decide on the future direction of UNAIDS. And we had a full day on tuberculosis, and there was great involvement of civil society. We had a marketplace, we had a number of very good speakers from civil society talking about tuberculosis and why it was important for the HIV response. And as a result, the PCB in the formal session, to my surprise, passed 9 resolutions on tuberculosis and the role of UNAIDS, co-sponsors, member states, civil society in reducing the burden of TB and people living with HIV. And these are just a few of the examples, and I think you can see there's a lot about civil society, building capacity, person-centered approach, etc., and bringing TB and HIV together. So again, this provided us with a lot of tools to be able to go to countries and start pushing better TB control within the HIV community. One example was somebody from WHO wrote to say thank you very much for having the PCB on TB, because now our UNAIDS country coordinator is really getting very much more involved in TB. He's moving the agenda much faster. He's all behind the TB-HIV integration at clinic level. They've just adopted the TB-HIV and drug user guidelines for the areas where there's high drug injecting drug use in Myanmar. So it's had a real impact in at country level. I think this is my last or second last slide. The next major event, the PCB was in April this year, and then in June this year we had the first HIV-TB Global Leaders Forum. And again, this was an agenda that was put together very carefully with the engagement of civil society representatives, and we put out a call for action. And it had to, it was done delicately to make sure it wasn't too shocking to a lot of the UN member states that would be attending. But civil society again said, no, this is inappropriate. This is not giving us the sense of urgency. It's really, if this is going to be a call for action, if you want us to sign up to it, it's got to be much more hardline and aggressive. And so we discussed it and passed it through everyone, because although this was embedded within the UN General Assembly special session, it was an informal meeting. If it had been in the UN General Assembly special session, it would have had to go to all the missions and get approved, etc. But we realised we didn't have to do that for this. So we thought, well, hang it, let's go for it. Let's put it in there. Let's make it as forceful as we can. And to our surprise, everybody accepted it. I mean, it's not a formal document. It doesn't actually hold any weight. It's not signed up by the UN. But the call for action was actually led over into the UN General Assembly and was presented to the Assembly by Jorge Sampaio, the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy, and it was accepted. Although it's not an official document, the call for action is actually in the records of the General Assembly Special Session. So, again, civil society really pushed the boundaries and raised the profile of TB within this very high-level HIV meeting. And actually, all the countries stand in the big UN General Assembly Hall, and they stand up and give their 5-minute talk on their HIV response. And I would say about half of them within that mentioned tuberculosis. And that simply wouldn't have happened 2 years ago or 4 years ago. So the importance of these planned advocacy events at getting TB back higher, much higher up on the international agenda is vital. And that then does trickle down to country-level action. And then just briefly, finally, and I think you'll hear from a number of other speakers who've been involved in this, what has civil society's role been in policy and advocacy monitoring and program monitoring at country level? The Open Society Institute Public Health Watch projects, they have an HIV, a TB-HIV and a TB project. And all of these has provided seed fundings to civil society organizations or individuals around the world to actually look at how their country is doing against its national plans and international policy declarations. And up to date, they've funded 53 individuals in 38 countries to carry out these projects. And again, the reports of these projects have been taken up at country level. They have identified gaps and problems in national program implementation, and at the same time has built the capacity of a number of civil society representatives and organizations to understand the diseases, to understand the policy and the implementation of policies, and to be very powerful advocates for the rights of people living with HIV or affected by TB. And more recently, the Stop TB Partnership Challenge Fund, which is just going into its second round, has also provided seed funding for community groups to build the advocacy and social mobilization activities. Unfortunately, we haven't heard the evaluation of the first round of funding, and in fact a number of us here will be involved in looking at the next proposals and hopefully also critically looking at the evaluation of the first round of funding. But again, I think a very useful source of funding to build civil society capacity. And I think that's it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Alistair. And in the interest of time, probably we would have all the questions at the end of all the presentations. Our next presenter is Carol Nyirenda. She is a TB-HIV activist working with a treatment advocacy and literacy campaign in Zambia. And she's also the coordinator of the Community Initiative for TB, HIV and Malaria in Zambia. She has been working with people living with HIV to do advocacy for increased implementation of TB HIV collaborative services. She's a community rep and a representative on the new diagnostic working group Stop TB Partnership, a board member of UNAID, and a community delegate alternate for the Global Fund. She's living openly and positively with HIV, and she has survived and undergone TB treatment. Let's put our hands together to welcome Carol.
Sorry, I'll need a hand on the technology. I wasn't sure how to use this. Thank you. As you heard from the introductions, I'm with the Treatment Advocates and Literacy Campaign. And I think for me this morning, I'll talk more about how my organization, TALC, integrated TB into our work. Alistair has given a good overview of the global level of TB, HIV, and I'll just talk about the community level. So the outline of my presentation will be talk a bit about the organization I work for, and then the treatment literacy trainings that we offer, and then how we disseminate this information, how and why TALC integrated TB into our HIV support work, and then the TB-HIV work that we're currently doing, as well as a few recommendations on how, as communities, we can work with the TB and HIV programs. So Treatment Advocacy and Literacy Campaign is a Zambian organization, NGO, that was formed to fight for equitable and sustainable access to HIV treatment, care and support for people living with HIV and AIDS. Like I said, initially we just started working around HIV. And then HIV advocacy and treatment literacy were initially what we just started. Our first programs were more around trainings on advocacy skills, HIV treatment literacy, and then basic science of HIV. Like I said, we were registered in 2004, focusing only on HIV treatment, but we realized through our talks and our meetings that most of us in the groups were co-infected. There are times when you're chatting through, with your friends, and somebody says, oh, I have TB this month. After 3, 4, 5 months, somebody else has TB. For us, it was like a co-infection, an opportunistic infection, and we didn't take it serious at that point. And then we also found out the emerging drug-resistant TB, that's the multi-drug-resistant TB, as well as extensively drug-resistant TB. We realized that as people living with HIV, we were like most at risk, so we thought we should take more notice of TB. There was also, we found out information about the, as well as that preventive therapy, information on the benefits of it for people living with HIV and AIDS. So we thought we should find out more about this and give this information to people living with HIV. There was also the Public Health Watch, that project that Alistair has talked about. Doing this project also broadened our understanding. So I thought I'll talk a bit about the Open Society Monitoring and Advocacy Project. In 2006, TALC conducted a research and monitoring project to find out the status of implementation of the WHO interim policy on collaborative TB-HIV activities and the IAC gap. I'm sure some of us are aware that Zambia, I'm from Zambia, is one of the countries that is a signatory to this policy. TALC was provided with training on TB-HIV basic science, TB tools, challenges for TB-HIV, the TB-HIV collaborative policy framework, and some guidance on TB-HIV advocacy priorities. Like I said before, it was from this research that we, as people living with HIV and AIDS in TALC and working around HIV work, understood more about TB issues firsthand. Because in this research, we went to the ground, we went to the communities, we went to the health centers, and we got a better understanding. And why we realized it was important that we integrate TB in our ongoing HIV work. OSI, the Open Society Institute, provided us with the funding and the capacity building for the organization and activities. And the Treatment Action Group provided the training on the technical issues related to TB-HIV and advocacy. So I thought I should talk a bit about the kind of treatment literacy training that we had before we even integrated the TB. The training that we offer at TALC is like in basic science of HIV. This is where we try and make people understand the HIV cycle, because we think it is important for somebody to know what is happening to their body. Like, for example, we try and make people living with HIV and AIDS understand the issues around the HIV cell, the CD4 cell, how the integration happens, how the replication happens, and also the importance of adherence to TB and HIV drugs, because we found out issues where if one is like HIV positive, they're put on TB drugs without even asking the doctors, they'll stop one of the drugs, and the importance of what happens when one skips a dose. Also, the importance of why we should take triple therapy and also continue with our TB treatment, as well as HIV and TB transmission, prevention, and care. Like I said, at first, we just talked about HIV, but now we give treatment literacy lessons along the two diseases. Also, human rights in the context of both diseases. So how do we give out this information as TALC? We give free treatment literacy lessons at the Secretariat. This is open, like we have these lessons every Friday. Anybody can come in from the community. This, we encourage people from the HIV and TB associations or community-based organizations. Another thing that we do is have trainings for leaders of support groups and community-based organizations who in turn go back to their communities and train their groups as well as the communities in the catchment areas. And in areas, because we also work in the communities, in the deep rural areas where there's a language barrier, it's very difficult to explain to somebody what the reverse transcriptase is or what the nucleoside, you know, whatever it is difficult. So what we do is we use a role play. This is where we have people, two groups. One group is the HIV cell, where you have the GP1, a person is a GP120, the other one is the protease, and then the other group is a group of people where you have the creation of the CD4 cell, where one person is the nucleus and everything, and then they act out the roles. So from that, it helps people understand what happens in their bodies. And then this cascades into the community. The people who are trained also go back to the communities. They teach their neighbors. They do this through drama, door-to-door sensitization, and focus group discussions. We also produce posters, IEC materials through posters, brochures. Usually with the brochures, we give to people who go into the community to do the sensitization. We also have a quarterly newsletter. This newsletter is produced by people living with HIV and AIDS and those affected by TB with no journalistic skills. Like, I was the editor of this newsletter for 3 years, and I've never had any journalistic training. And then a bit more, again, just quickly to talk about the project. It was about the WHO interim policy on TB-HIV collaborative activity. Like I said already, Zambia is a signatory to this policy. So what happened was that the TAG community researchers, we underwent a training. Actually, the lead researcher was trained by TAG first, and then this training was given to the members of the research team. The areas we covered in Zambia were three provinces, namely Lusaka province, Central province, and the Copperbelt province. And this is the areas where TAUC has a presence. And then the key informants, where we interviewed policymakers, affected communities, health workers, and NGOs working around the two diseases. The method we used were desk interviews and questionnaires. The questionnaires were a bit long, so some people who are busy, especially policymakers, wouldn't let us have one-to-one interviews with them, so we'd leave them the questionnaires and then pick them up the following day and have a shorter interview with them. So a few of the findings that we found were that there was separation of services at health center level, and then there was lack of information on the core infection. Even with the trainings, if you go to the HIV sector, all they had was training or information around HIV and vice versa for the TB section as well. And then again, like I said, the interim policy and then lack of meaningful involvement of affected communities in the joint collaborative body. This is, I think, one of the requirements of the joint collaborative of the WHO interim policy, that people have JCBs in their country. We found that Zambia had a JCB, but then there wasn't any meaningful involvement of the affected community. Then the impact of this project on TAUC, it increased the knowledge on TB-HIV and the active involvement of the co-infected in the TB joint collaborative body. And then what we did to get more people in the JCB was we had a three-day training of TB-HIV co-infection to increase knowledge and capacity of 15 TAUC members to support subsequent advocacy activities. These are people who already had received training, advocacy training, as well as HIV training. All we did was add in the TB component. And then after that, we had a two-day training for 35 advocates and leaders of community-based organizations, as well as support groups from three provinces. In this training, actually, we did include a few healthcare workers. These are nurses from the TB corner and the HIV corners from the healthcare centers. After this, we had a one-day stakeholders meeting where we invited officials from the Ministry of Health and the National AIDS Council to sort of talk to them about issues, why we felt we needed more representation on the JCB. And this was quite helpful, because from this, actually, I think in later presentation, I will explain how at least now TAUC is more engaged at the policy level. This also increased the coverage. We also increased the coverage of TB in the TAUC newsletter. We now have two pages where we only talk about TB matters and the core infection. And then there's also an increased demand on TAUC's membership to seek out TB diagnostics and awareness of symptoms. That's the intensified case findings. Like I said, we sit in our meetings and we're in a close setting and one of you is coughing and we joke about it. Oh, what you have is TB, and it was like a joke. But now people started taking it serious to say, if we're going to sit in a close place with somebody with TB, we have a chance of also catching that. And then also advocacy to create HIV desks at TB clinics and vice versa. What we have currently is that HIV centers, you know, as you know, our doctors are overwhelmed. And usually when somebody goes to access treatment, the doctors are too busy to give them more information about the art treatment or adherence. So we have what we call HIV desks outside the art clinics. So what we are doing now is we're also having these HIV desks outside TB centers so that when one goes to access TB treatment, they can have the information on HIV, and if there's need for them to access the other treatment, then they can go to the other department. So like I said, TALC is now being invited to TB HIV meetings at national level and sitting at the table as partners. I think just 2 weeks before I came here, there was a meeting that was called to review the TB HIV national guidelines, and TALC was invited as a partner to the review. And then support group members at clinics are giving HIV health talks at TB corners and vice versa. Initially, it was HIV at HIV corners. Now, the HIV people are going to the TB corners and vice versa. And there are more people now asking for information about the core infection. Now that people know that TALC has integrated TB in their work, that people come into TALC when they want more information on TB, especially on IPT for people living with HIV and AIDS. As most of us know, that is still a contentious issue, so we're working around that. There's also more uptake of services noted at some clinics from both clinics. And there are more TB HIV support groups being formed around the country. People come to TALC because we have now formed TB HIV support groups around the country, and people usually come to TALC to ask us to help them form these support groups. So what are TALC's future plans? We plan to continue with the TB science training for HIV advocates, as well as community health workers. These are TB and HIV treatment supporters. One of the reasons why we're talking about training more health supporters is that we found out that some of these myths around transmission, like I went to a training in the community where I found somebody from the ministry telling people that you can catch TB by sharing utensils. And some of this information actually comes from the healthcare workers themselves who don't have the correct information. So that's why we would like to intensify that. And then we also want to also push for the advocates around the three I's, that's intensified case finding, infection control, and IPT. And also, like I said, have more support, TB HIV support groups, have TB champions as role models, have people who have both diseases, or the ones, especially the ones who've just had TB, to come out in the open and share their experiences and encourage other people to go for treatment. Because some people don't even know that TB treatment is free. And then we intend to continue with the massive IEC campaign. There's the patient's charter, that the TB patient's charter that very few people know about, so we give that to people. The door-to-door sensitization, and we also intend to have go on radio. We have community radio stations in Zambia where we want to talk more about TB. And then community mobilization, because what we realize is that once people are aware that TB, though it's transmittable, it's treatable and free, they'll like talk to their neighbors, so people at the church, you know, for early referral. If you see somebody coughing for more than 3 weeks, then they'll like tell the person to go to the clinic. So how can TB communities support HIV activists to take on TB? Provide us with information. Like, we all know information is power. Help us understand why TB is a concern for people living with HIV and AIDS. Communities are much more than just DOTS supporters. You know, we have a bigger role to play in the collaborative activities. Create a supportive policy and program environment that encourages this leadership in policy, research, resource allocation, and program implementation, especially at national level. You find that there's so much being done at global level, but we have very little that we do at national level. And then also the HIV and TB programs need to budget into their program efforts that will support civil society partners in doing this important work. Activists can increase political support and resources for TB and TB-HIV at national and global level. And then also creating an activist movement for TB-HIV can create demand for increased collaboration at local, national levels. Again, like I said, having the TB desks at VCT sites and at clinics and vice versa. The HIV community can improve program outcomes, especially for treatment completion, infection control, and intensified case finding. So the conclusion, we are the ultimate beneficiaries of these services, and our insights will be critical in improving the service delivery and outcome measures. TB has been medicalized for too long, and the fight against TB needs our support and for us to work together. Thank you. Merci.
Synext. I have the great privilege to introduce Tamari. Tamari is from Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, not the state in the U.S., as most people seem to assume as soon as we hear Georgia. And she's the lead researcher for the Public Health Watch project on TB HIV monitoring and advocacy for the Welfare Foundation that's based in Tbilisi in Georgia. And the foundation does work around healthcare, around poverty alleviation, and social welfare and attempts to do this through research and advocacy and to improve the quality of life of poor through this effort.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Javid, for this nice introduction, and thank you, everyone, for coming. Good morning. I would like to present you a project which was implemented by an organization which I'm working for, and it is a welfare foundation in Georgia, in Tbilisi, Georgia. And first of all, I would like to give you a brief information about the country I come from, though I'm sure most of you heard about Georgia, and especially after this all latest negative military developments and after aggression from Russia. However, Georgia is a country in Eastern Europe with a high prevalence of TB infection and relatively low prevalence of HIV/AIDS. And amongst the low prevalent countries, it's even the last ones among low prevalent countries with 0.2% among adult population. But the contrary situation is different with tuberculosis. And tuberculosis is one of the leading causes of morbidity in Georgia nowadays, and especially the situation is getting very scary with regards to TB drug-resistant forms. Multi-drug-resistant form and XDR as well is registered in Georgia. Here I would like to give you a couple of slides from the latest WHO Global Report on Anti-Tuberculosis Drug Resistance in the World, which was issued in 2008, and Georgia is among 14 settings with MDR-TB among new cases greater than 6%, and here it's the last, but it's 7% of MDR among new cases of tuberculosis. Here we see that Georgia is among settings where resistance to any TB drugs amongst the newly diagnosed TB is more than 30%, and if we look thoroughly, it's like 50%, meaning that every second newly diagnosed tuberculosis in Georgia is resistant to any TB drug from the first-line TB antibiotics. Situation is also difficult with regards of previously treated cases, and here is 30% of previously treated cases are resistant to first-line TB drugs. And with all these understandings, we came to the project, which was talked about from Carol and from Alistair. In 2006, 12 NGOs from 12 countries was given support from Public Health Watch Program of Open Society Institute in terms of financial support and building capacity of project staff and providing technical support from Treatment Action Group. In order to conduct a monitoring and advocacy project to assess the extent of TB-HIV collaborative activities in respective countries. The primary mission of the project was to increase civil society participation in policy-making efforts around the adoption of TB-HIV, WHO collaborative activities on TB-HIV. And basically, the project consisted of two phases. First was monitoring phase, which was done through interviews. The questionnaire was developed based on WHO interim policy. And we went and interviewed 24 main stakeholders, including everyone who is working with TB and HIV issues in Georgia. And later on the findings of monitoring phase, we started our advocacy campaign. Here I listed some of the key findings. There were really very many of findings after the monitoring phase, and here are some of them, and I would like to highlight. TB-HIV collaborative activities in Georgia are improving. The coordinating body is established. However, the practical collaboration still to this extent is minimal. And one important finding was that the involvement, the meaningful involvement of people affected with and infected with tuberculosis and HIV is very little. In the issues of tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS in Georgia. There is lack of government accountability towards public in general and in healthcare issues in particular. Since the collapse of Soviet Union, our healthcare system is undergoing through a major transformation, but so far it's very difficult to see the strategic plan from Ministry of Health, what we are going to achieve and what we are going to see and what direction we are going. They have dozens of these strategic plans which they easily change with the new ministers. One of the findings was that the public awareness about tuberculosis, about the co-infection as well as tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS was very low. Not only in general population, but about the co-infection was lower even among healthcare professionals. And in yellow, I highlighted the finding which we later advocated for and which we still are going to advocate. And it is related to irrational drug use in Georgia. And it is related to the issue that the TB drugs, all first-line drugs and some of the second-line drugs are available and are sold prescription-free in the pharmacies, meaning that everyone who wants can go to the pharmacy and buy it without doctor's prescription, as well as all the other antibiotics. And in regard to seeing those slides, if you remember from WHO latest report that the resistance is very high and every second newly diagnosed TB is resistant to at least one drug which is used to treat first-line drugs, among first-line drugs, it's getting very serious and the situation is really very scary and needs to be taken care of. So our advocacy target was to contribute in favor of new policy guidelines against the availability of prescription-free TB antibiotics in Georgia. It is a very challenging, it was from the beginning, we thought that it was very challenging and ambitious advocacy goal, but however, according and on the situation and that the TB is posing such a great challenge to our society, we decided to advocate for this issue. And it is not completely unrealistic that we can achieve it and that we can achieve a restriction of at least only first-line drugs which is used to cure TB, which should be specifically used to cure TB, but in Georgia they are used even for common cold or the persons, they can go to the pharmacy without going first to the doctor and buying rifampicin or isoniazid and take it. We drew the specific objectives for our advocacy plane and we wanted to gain support from as many parties which are involved on tuberculosis and HIV issues in Georgia, as many as possible. We wanted to raise awareness and gain and secure support from civil society organizations, from NGOs, from community-based organizations, affected and infected communities. We wanted to get support and get credible arguments for our policymakers and get support from healthcare providers on TB and HIV services to make them understand why it is so bad to sell this antibiotic, to have them available in the pharmacies. And the last step we wanted, with all this support, with all this arguments, we want the letter of support from TB and HIV/AIDS service providers wanted to be engaged in a dialogue with decision makers from the Ministry of Health, Labour, Health and Social Affairs of Georgia and the Parliamentary Health Committee about the consequences of accessing prescription-free TB antibiotics. The target audience, it's not that prioritized like a primary, secondary, all of them were the target audience for us, society, civil society representatives, policymakers, healthcare providers. We tried all these different perspectives and different avenues to tackle. And here are some key advocacy interventions, what we've gone through from the very beginning of the project. We did overall problem analysis very thoroughly, and we identified goals and objectives. We defined the key messages for policymakers, for healthcare providers. We identified our allies and partners and influencing of opportunities. Was it in tactics? Was it campaigning? Was it roundtable discussions or organizing conference? Treatment literacy was one of the cornerstones of our advocacy campaign. We issued a number of booklets and leaflets, and especially important was the booklets for the patients and for the doctors, highlighting the importance of adherence to TB and antibiotics in general. In general, antibiotics treatment, and why it is important not to quit treatment and to follow it till the end. And also, we translated the patient charter on tuberculosis from Stop TB Partnership, which highlights the responsibility and rights and responsibility about patients in a patient-friendly manner. And it puts together patients, healthcare providers, and policymakers, and unites them around the issue of tuberculosis. And one of the important steps was development of strong and persuasive materials for the policymakers, like fact sheets with the monitoring key findings. And meetings, a lot of meetings with the patients, with affected communities, with healthcare providers, with representatives of Ministry of Health and representatives of Parliamentary Health Committee. And the final step was advocacy conference, which was just recently on 3rd of October, and used as a platform to creation of TB support team. We tried very hard to find the famous the faces of tuberculosis. We wanted to find persons who had and who want to talk about the tuberculosis in a close, in open manner among the famous persons, and found that the Minister of Health of ours and the Vice Speaker of the Parliament are TB, treated TB patient, and they wanted to talk about it, and they wanted to be engaged in all these issues. And as well as this conference served as an important tool to bringing together all these different parties and stakeholders related to TB in Georgia. And one of the issue of the conference was to present an analytical paper, which our research team worked on, and it was describing best practices of the countries which once faced the problem of prescription-free antibiotics and how they overcome it. And we presented different examples, and one of them was example from Azerbaijan after they are facing the greater problem of MDR-TB greater than Georgia. They decided to restrict first TB. They had also available first line TB drugs, and we discussed this document as well. And this advocacy conference was an important tool for us to increase political support for TB and TB-HIV on national level, and to be ensured that TB is always on the agenda of our politicians. And we discussed these necessary steps to move forward in favor of adoption of the most appropriate way of restriction of these first-line drugs. And we prepared the letter for the Ministry of Health and Social Affairs, and we signed, and we now are following up with this letter. And here I want to share with you some lessons which we learned after the monitoring and advocacy issues, and what was important for us, for the civil monitors of the policy around the TB-HIV issues in Georgia. One of important things is that direct experience has real value for us, for the civil monitors, for the people who come from the civil societies, because it increases capacity of the communities. At the same time, it's effective. At the same time, it is not possible to design effective services without the input of people who are going to use these services. And the citizen monitors have the privilege to be independent. They can say some things which bureaucrats never can say. And one thing was very important to establishing credibility for us through making ourselves familiarized with the policy issues, with the TB-HIV co-infection issues, because for the most of us it was a new issue, and for most of us it was a great challenge from the beginning. So it is an important step to establish credibility. And one important thing what we found in Georgia, maybe for the specific of countries what Georgia is, that is, it is very important to strike to a constructive tone. Like when we go to the policymakers and politicians, we say that we, of course, appreciate and acknowledge what they've done. And they really do things, and they really do things what they think it is right to do. And we say that we acknowledge, but still, here, look, there are gaps and there are weaknesses, what should be addressed. And we go and we offer our help, and it is very important to go with the concrete things. Like when you say something, that something is lacking and missing, you always have a proposed solution. What is it going to be? So we should give them our perspectives, and we should give our role in solving this problem. So constructive critique leads to a better, to our understanding, it leads to a better and more efficient and effective policies and services. And importance of convincing arguments and the proposition of solution, as I've talked, and later, and the last and not least, is that public engagement contributes to greater accountability of the government to us. So here is my last slide with what I want to share with you. And if we summarize all these things, if we want to reach the long-lasting changes, we need credible arguments to convince decision makers, and we need sufficiently broad and intense support from different parties, and we need allies and supporters, and we need a capacity for us, for civil society representatives, and an infrastructure and which sustains the change. And we need the mass attitude and beliefs that also sustain change and sometimes are the change. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamari. Our next speaker is going to be Ezio. Ezio Tavora is a Public Health Watch TB Monitoring Project researcher and a lawyer, longtime HIV and TB activist. And since 2002, he has been involved in a social mobilization for TB control, and as an AIDS activist for nearly a decade. Santos has helped found and manage several non-government organizations that support people living with HIV and AIDS in Brazil. Ezio, you're welcome.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for your brave energy to be here Sunday morning in Paris and and resisting to so many presentations. I'll just grab some water. Well, I was invited to share some experience about the building community support to research, and this has to do with a lot that the previous presenters have shown to you. Well, but first I would like to share with you some ideas. I mean, about consciousness. I mean, do people with AIDS aware that they are particularly vulnerable to tuberculosis? And actually, do people with HIV and AIDS know what tuberculosis is? That's a question. And, well, the answer is no, they don't. We have been working on this since 2002. 2002, I started to work on TB and TB-HIV. And it was clear to me, I first organized some workshops down in Brazil back in 2003 to do first social mobilization. And it was clear that the civil society didn't have any clue of what was the dimension of the problem, especially in my state. I live in Rio de Janeiro, where has the highest prevalence in the country and the highest incident rates. Although it's decreasing, it is a very serious matter. And as in the majority of the states in Brazil, it is the major cause of death. And people with AIDS were not aware of the problem. So the majority of people living with HIV and AIDS affected by TB, they are basically living in poverty. So the second question is, should we expect that they will become activists and consider educational and treatment and research literature as their first priorities? I don't think so. So our role is then we have to think in what is our role and how we are seen and how we put yourself or how we present ourselves to the others. I mean, basically the another question is, how do researchers and clinicians and healthcare servants see people with TB or with HIV and AIDS? Are they patients or are they persons? Well, certainly they see people as patients, as so something that is passive, that's supposed to receive the treatment and follow the guidelines and follow the prescription, but not as persons which have some particularities. And the question is, are researchers truly considering the needs and conditions of people affected? Well, I don't think so, because people affected are more seen as object of the studies than subject of them, and because of that, many research has not actually been designed by them. So when we think about consent, I would like to think about, bring a little about the HIV and AIDS history, because when people understood, I mean, when in the as Alasdair has raised first, I mean, in the TB community, in the TB's history of treatment, I mean, there was it's a long and solid and very structured and very bureaucratic field. Another day here during this conference, I was saying that how boring was the first union meeting that I visited, and sometimes some sessions still are. I mean, we have to be more dynamic, and because it's otherwise we really going to get stuck. But the thing is that in the HIV and AIDS field, there was an understanding of the benefits of research, because there was nothing on the ground, and as I said the other day here, I mean, the thing is that people tend to think that the few drugs they have, because they are so used with them for 40 years, that they hardly believe there will be something new, but they will. So, but to have something new, we have to go further, and then we have to be participating in the design of clinical studies to say what kind of drug we want, that the drugs, the TB drugs, have to work with the AIDS drugs, and so on and so forth. So, instead of if people affected getting involved and understand the need of research, actually they will not be giving consent. I'm not saying that consent is not important; that it will always be important. But people, rather than having to give consent to be studied, he or she will be studying together. I mean, they will be participating in requiring research. So, well, in HIV and AIDS, actually, it was the fear of the unknown, the fear of death. I don't know why. Well, a Freudian moment that I had here. I mean, remembering my mother when I was diagnosed with HIV and AIDS back in 85. In 85, HIV was not even called HIV. It was still HDLV3, the French name, or the LAV and LAV. And my mother used to boil all my clothes and all the stuff and all the thing. I got to remember this morning. I said, my gosh, yeah, I have been through that also. I have forgotten that. Yeah, but it's I think it was because Carol was mentioning that about sharing utensils at home and so on and so forth. But actually, that was the fear of unknown, the fear of death, that led people to be to have the urgency. But a lot of people are dying with TB, and where's the urgency? Because the difference is who is dying. I mean, in the 80s, I mean, there was an elite of people who have very close contact to the media, high educational skills, and capacity to articulate. And these people were able to put policies forward. I mean, it was basically in the Western world a gay, upper middle class, white community that was in the arts area, in the field, in the fashion field, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of attention brought to this. People, very known people, and that helped actually somehow the movement to go further, and also gay activists were dying, and they were activists, so they were became AIDS activists, and there was this fear of discrimination and annihilation. No? So that was the urgency, and then there was the urgency to scaling up the studies, and the anticipating the protocol approvals and making diagnostics and drugs available. That was the result. I mean, the name of my organization is Grupo Pela Vida, and Vida is, Vida with one D in Portuguese, as in Spanish, means life. But with the double V, it's actually something that the writer Herbert Daniel, who created my organization, the idea was to add value, integrate, and dignify those diseases of AIDS. And since the 80s, I mean, most of these people had TB or died of TB. And the idea of the organization is to recuperate and conquer citizenship. That was the idea. And to annihilate stigma, to be recognized as equal. And that's the point when we talk about research. I mean, we have to be seen as equals. We have to show ourselves or to show interest and go for literature and for the research initiatives as equal and not as just an object of study. But the objectives, what we need, we need, obviously, this is common sense to each one of us, that we need new diagnostic, new tools, new drugs, and an effective vaccine. But the question is, are we doing right? And are we talking to the right people? Are we doing enough? Because sometimes I have the sensation that we become advocates for ourselves. Sometimes I have the sensation that people keep talking to the community. That's the wrong place to make advocacy. That's not a place. I mean, this conference is the wrong place to share leaflets. And I mean, you're throwing paper away. I mean, you have to put these leaflets down on the street. The other day I was mentioning that a colleague of mine, a researcher, the most important TB-HIV research in Brazil, who did her PhD in Paris, was given a lecture in the hospital where she studied here, and found out that the healthcare workers were not using masks, and none of them do any PPD. There was no infection control in the hospital that she's doing among the healthcare workers. And this is Paris. And that's where she did her PhD. So, I mean, and then a Brazilian comes here to say, you have to wear masks. And you have to do PPD. You have to control to see if, how is infection going in your hospital. So, I mean, we have to talk to the right people. And sometimes the right people is our healthcare workers, but these people are basically on the street. And the idea is that activists should appropriate, get the knowledge, make part of scientific production, to occupy spaces, to do what the AIDS movement has done in the 80s, and to go beyond diagnostics, beyond this patient's role. But we have to plan how to get there. I mean, it's not easy, and it's not a simple thing to do, because we work, again, in a very poor environment where most of people affected by TB have very low education skills. So that's very difficult to imagine how they will get involved. But there are some interesting experiences. The TB network in Brazil, which is in Portuguese called the Rede TB, it's a network of researchers and clinicians, operational researchers, and activists. I'm also part of it. I'm responsible for community mobilization, and they are implementing the ICORTA program. They are the ICORTA, which is the International Clinical Operational and Health Services Research Training Award for AIDS and Tuberculosis by NIAID. They are the implementers of the Federal University of Rio, the State University of São Paulo, and the University of Espírito Santo. They are training professionals in four levels. I mean, basically four community activists, four healthcare workers, the community healthcare workers, up to postgraduate studies. So doing research and engaging in that. And the TH Rio Create initiative also has been doing sensitization of professionals and activists with IPT for the last years. And this has inspired me to organize the community and research seminar, which was held in Rio May last year, which was the objective was to pick up key activists in the country and put them to sit together with key researchers in the country and discuss how activists should be more engaged in research, to discuss why they don't engage, to show some activists which are engaged in research, and to see how we can move forward. So the immediate result of this seminar is that there was an increase in community participation in CABS and in Ethics Commission. I mean, in Rio, that was immediate, and at least three community advisory boards have mentioned to me that there was an immediate increase of the community participation after the seminar, and in Ethics Commissions as well. So, and we are expanding these experiences there are new opportunities for operational research that is a chance to measure patient satisfaction and treatment compliance and services among, for example, the new Brazilian CCM project to the Global Fund. to do research, and because there are new spaces like the metropolitan committees, which can propose after this second year of implementation to do specific research. So the community members can actually suggest the research which will be implemented. And my colleagues have already mentioned all the initiatives of the monitoring initiatives by OSI that started actually in 2004. I started the research in 2005. 2 years ago, in 2006, we released the TB policies here in Paris. And I was responsible for the Brazil report, and my colleague Olaid here was responsible for the Nigerian report, and also the most recent TB-HIV advocacy project by TAG and ICW, which actually TAG started back in 2002, with first by itself, and then with partnering with OSI, and recently in the last 2 years partnering with ICW, and mapping and. Recently, we have also a PAHO initiative, mapping and documenting innovative control activities by communities in Latin America. And a very important thing is also an initiative by TAG and ICW to actually to evaluate the efficacy and the impact of these new community actors in the TB policies. This is crucial to do, because that's how we really will understand how we are doing and if we are doing it really right. And further, I mean, we are organizing now in the next month a new training to empower communities on TB and TB-HIV. Actually, the title is to overcome resistance. It's not only MDR, but also the resistance to do research, to go for literacy, and to do more. So the idea is to add new partners. So that's an initiative that I'm organizing on behalf of the Brazilian Stop TB with all the partners. It will be a satellite event to the next PWA National Conference, which is held by my organization, organized for already 17 years by my organization in Brazil. And we will have a new partner, which will be the private sector, Lilly, because we have always have been very resistant to have a partnering with private sector, but we are moving forward. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Azia. So now that last speaker is going to be Olaide Akani. She's from the Journalist Against AIDS in Nigeria, and she's the executive director of the Journalist Against AIDS there. And besides her work at Journalist Against AIDS, she's also been involved in the African Civil Society Coalition and the Pan-African Treatment Access Movement, promoting HIV/AIDS and TB treatment literacy capacity building for media and civil society groups. And she's also been involved in policy and policy monitoring on universal access to prevention, treatment, and care services.
Good morning, everyone. I think one of the challenges of speaking last is that everybody has said all you need to say, and you have very little time to say what you want to say. So I'm going to be speaking about the activist roles in TB-HIV resource mobilization, but I think many of the previous speakers have alluded to a lot of what I'm going to say, so I think maybe this is just going to be a recap for what needs to be said. Okay. They say a picture speaks a thousand words, so this is activism at work. The first was at the World Social Forum in January 2007 in Nairobi. The World Social Forum is an open space where everybody wants to say what they want to say. But we use that platform to talk about universal access and the need for advocates and activists to get involved in HIV, TB, and malaria. And we use that also to call on African leaders, you know, to stake to their commitments about making access to universal access for HIV, TB, and malaria by 2010. Then also, we also had a platform at the African Health Ministers meeting in Joburg in April 2007, and there was a demonstration which was coordinated by the Treatment Action Campaign, And at the end of that, we were able to present to the ministers our charge to for them to accelerate treatment access and make sure they actually commit resources, the necessary resources to do that. So what are the roles of civil society in TB HIV resource monitoring, resource mobilization? I think a lot of my colleagues have stated that, and I'll just reemphasize that. Number one, we have a watchdog role, particularly in monitoring. And the second role will be in participation in decision-making processes around resource allocation. Now, oftentimes you hear, you know, the fact that people say that there is a resistance. Thank you very much, Javid. There is a resistance to engaging civil society, particularly at national level. And oftentimes the question is, what are you bringing to the table? Why must we engage civil society? I think that from all of the presentations that we've heard today, it's clear that civil society participation brings a reality check, because when civil society is involved, you get to know what the perspectives are from an international, regional, and a country level, because this is about real people who are accessing TB-HIV care, presenting their real challenges, and also practical solutions on what needs to be done. And I think that in many of these TB-HIV meetings, that has been demonstrated very actively and efficiently by the likes of Winston Zulu, Lucy Chesire, and many other activists around the world who keep on emphasizing and bringing the face of TB-HIV to the table. And I also think that the reality check is demonstrated in what Ezio had alluded to about what we had done with Open Society Institute in monitoring what is actually happening on TB-HIV implementation at national country level. I think another issue that, another role that we can bring to the table is research in TB-HIV resource allocation. In the past 3-4 years, the Treatment Action Group has been actively involved in analyzing the funding trends in TB-HIV, in TB research, you know, and they have presented this report continually. I know that in South Africa, IDASA and TAC have also actually been involved in monitoring HIV resource allocation, and that kind of gives a sense of, you know, how much money is being allocated. We also started, we referring to Journalists Against AIDS, we are also doing a monitoring of how much money is going into HIV and AIDS, particularly from the government, and that is called the Monitor Project. So I think these are part of the work that we can bring to the table. So I think that from the experiences of TAG and from JAIDS, one of the things we can actively do is TB-HIV resource tracking. And in doing TB-HIV resource tracking, some key questions that we as civil society can do research into and get answers to is, how much money is government actually spending on TB-HIV? Does political commitment truly translate to financial commitment? One of the things we found out while doing the OSI monitoring is that, yes, in many political spaces, governments have said, we support, the global fight and the global plan to stop TB. But is that commitment actually translating to financial commitment? Are they putting their money where their mouth is? Is whatever money is allocated, is it commensurate with the country-level universal access targets and the country strategic plans for TB-HIV? These are some of the questions that we can ask. Is current spending reflecting country priorities? Is the spending yielding maximum results? Are underserved communities and vulnerable populations accessing care? Are the principles of equity and human rights guiding the spending on TB-HIV? These are issues that we can bring to the table from a civil society perspective, particularly as we look at how much resources is going into TB-HIV. What else can we bring to the table? I think that a lot of the previous speakers have said that we can demand accountability from high-level leadership, moving, you know, and asking them, are they actually moving from rhetoric to action? I know that I think about 2 years ago, some other civil society groups had actually done TB-HIV scorecards to kind of track how countries were performing as regards to TB-HIV. Some of us are also engaged, and we're clamoring for more spaces for engagement in policy processes such as the CCMs, the country coordinating mechanisms, the UNITAID, and the Global Fund Board. And these are opportunities for civil society on these boards to actually push forward the case for increased resource allocation for TB. And I think it's also important to partner with other whistleblowers like the media so that we can whatever information we generate, we can also make publicly publicly accessible. For instance, the outcomes of the TAG research, you know, once it's in the media space, other people can get to know what is happening with TB, and that can also sensitize more activists to get involved and continue to demand from their governments more accountability. I think it's also important for us to remind leadership of failed promises and demand urgent action. So many promises have been made. As far back as 2001 in Abuja, Nigeria, African heads of state got together and said they were going to allocate 15% of their budgets to HIV, TB, and malaria. And I think up until now, only about four African countries have met that target. So these are opportunities for civil society to demand and act for increased allocation of resources. The Maputo Declaration was also an evidence of African health ministers coming together to declare TB as an emergency. And if TB was declared an emergency about 2-3 years ago and there isn't so much happening with TB, that means that we're not prioritizing TB. For instance, if you say there's an emergency, it means your house is on fire. Now, if your house is on fire, you're not going to, like, sit around the table and say, okay, so the house is on fire. What do we do? How do we plan? Of course, you get out of there and call the, call as many people as possible, bring water. You don't sit around the table and have round table conferences when your house is on fire. You do something about it, and you do something urgent. So the question is, you know, is an emergency just an emergency for emergency's sake, or, you know, maybe there's a new definition of emergency that we don't know about. Okay, so another place, you know, another platform is the UNGAS Declaration, and last UNGAS in 2008, there was a HIV-TB Global Leaders Forum that Alistair had alluded to, and that was also another opportunity to bring, you know, to the attention of the political leadership, the importance of getting TB and HIV working together. The G8 commitments to universal access, as far back as 2005, the G8 met in Gleneagles, and they said they were going to commit $60 billion to TB, HIV, AIDS, and malaria. And I know that up until the meeting that they had in Tokyo, the G8 in Tokyo in July, activists were still asking the questions, where is the money? How much money has been allocated? Is there a plan on how that money is going to be allocated? There's still no plan. They just said they were going to commit this amount of money. Nobody knows how much each country is going to contribute. And these are issues that we can, as civil society, continue to ask and demand urgency from government about. So what are the lessons learned from monitoring resource allocation? And I'm just going to share some of the lessons from what we have done in HIV. I think that oftentimes we produce this annual report at the end of the year showing how much has been allocated and what exactly, because when you see how much has been allocated, it gives you a sense of what the priorities are, where the money is going and stuff like that. And sharing these outcomes with other civil society groups in country has kind of stimulated their interest and awareness in budget, about budget processes, because oftentimes civil society doesn't really care about budget processes. They just know, okay, so amount has been allocated. But if you have the skills and you understand budget monitoring very effectively, then the next time the budget process is going to, the next time we're planning to put together the budget, you want to be there because you want to be sure that, you know, the priorities are actually given the most money, you know. So that has helped to inform civil society in utilizing the findings as a tool to engage leadership at local levels and to demand for increased resource allocation. And that has also stimulated other groups to do similar researches at the local level and to demand public accountability. And so I think that these are lessons that we can also translate to TB. While I must commend what TAG has done on research, I think that we as civil society groups at country level should also begin to do those kind of researches to actually find out how much money, how much of the national budget is going into TB, what is it being used for. And I think that one of the beautiful lessons from Georgia and from Tamara's presentation is that oftentimes in engaging with policymakers, you truly need an evidence base. Sometimes in some platforms, you know, making the noise works. But in other platforms, if you actually want to hear the if you want the policymakers to listen to you, you need to be able to provide evidence that you have done your homework well, you have done research, and you can, you know, convince them based on your facts that, you know, this isn't right and you need to do more. And I think that that is one role that we as civil society need to take up much more actively, particularly budget monitoring and engaging with policymakers on their own platform. I also think we need to be much more effective in demanding increased allocation of resources from international funding mechanisms such as the Global Fund, PEPFAR, multilaterals like the World Bank. The HIV and AIDS activists have done a lot of that, pushing them, demanding that, you know, you fund the fund, demanding from World Bank to act up in some other instances at country level. I know that the World Bank in many African countries has a HIV and AIDS fund, but I don't know how many countries in which the World Bank has a TB fund. And these are platforms that we can actually demand for more commitment and allocation of resources. Apart from the monetary aspect, because we're talking about resource mobilization, I think civil society are a great resource for TB HIV work. And Carol had alluded to the fact that, you know, as civil society, we can do a lot of treatment, literacy, adherence, counseling, support, and home-based care. And this is part of contributing to the resource, particularly bridging the health worker crisis that we face in many African countries. Now, while we have outlined, many of us have outlined a list of activities that civil society or roles that civil society can bring to the table, it's also important to understand that civil society needs to be supported to fulfill these roles. Yes, we can do these roles, but we need your support. You know, we need the support of many groups to do these roles effectively. And one of the things I'd say is that for effectiveness, civil societies will need to improve on partnerships and depend on comparative advantages, networking, and information sharing. All of us cannot do resource tracking. Some of us have the skills in that. And so we need to leverage on the skills of others who can do that. Not all of us can meet with the Gordon Browns of this world or U.S. president. Some of us have to meet on our behalf with those people. But we also need to be able to support them, provide them with the background and the information that they might need to be able to do that effectively. When we do such resource tracking, some of us have to engage with the media to make sure that that information is out in the public space. So we need to be able to leverage on our comparative advantages to be able to be more effective. And so I said that such support will include grants from independent organizations who are willing to strengthen TB-HIV activism at country, regional, and at international level. I know that we had been in some other sessions in this meeting, and one of the things that is clear is that if you do want to do TB-HIV activism effectively, you can't depend on government funding, because, number one, government is not going to fund you to shoot them in the foot. You need to have independent funding to be able to do that. And so we also need support to do evidence-based research, because as we have heard from some of these previous speakers, we need that evidence base to engage effectively. We also need capacity to better improve understanding of the issues of TB-HIV, because without that information, you probably will look very blank if you're engaging with a policymaker who has been engaged in TB work for 20 years, probably before you were born. You know, and it's also important to create spaces for civil society engagement with policymakers. If we don't have support for participation in high-level meetings, our voices will not be heard in those high-level meetings. So it's important for other partners to also help us create those spaces so that we can engage effectively. Last slide, lessons from HIV/AIDS activism. I know there are a lot of lessons, but I just wanted to highlight some of them here. One of them is from the Treatment Action Campaign, and I'm sure everybody is very familiar with that, because they had been so much in the forefront of demanding leadership and accountability from the governments. Some years ago, the government finally decided to agree to roll out antiretroviral treatment. And so, you know, there has been progress because of the activism of the Treatment Action Campaign. And I also know that back in Nigeria, at the ICASA 2005 conference that held in Nigeria, several activists got together and actually demonstrated the fact that access to treatment was still very difficult because of the user fees that were still attached to that. And shortly after that conference, the Nigerian president, the former Nigerian president, announced a free ARV treatment policy. And that was also, of course, there were a lot of other players that were involved in that process, but I think the activism played a very important role in ensuring that treatment eventually became free. So these are lessons, and we need to explore how we can take this forward, particularly for TB activism as well. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening.
So now we'll call all the speakers to take, the five speakers to take the four seats. actually, maybe that will work. Yeah. And just to remind people that please speak into the mics, because if you have any questions, it would be important to have them recorded as well. So as you can see from the speakers, as we were when we're creating this panel, we really wanted to focus on different aspects of advocacy and how advocacy could contribute to different elements of political support, research, and treatment literacy, as well as resource mobilization, and specifically around, you know, TB-HIV or MDR-TB. So I hope that this has given a lot of ideas for us to think about what kind of support can we provide as the TB community to TB-HIV activists or activists in general. But I'd love to hear from you if you have any questions for the activists. Please go to one of the mics.
Good morning. My name is Svetlana Okromeshko, and I work for PATH, Program for Appropriate Technology and Health. This is American NGO. And first of all, I want to thank you, panel organizers, for first of all, for selecting such an important topic, and then for inviting just great presenters. I enjoyed every presentation. But I have a question for Tamari. I am involved in projects that are implemented in Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, and I work in Georgia also, so it's very close to me, to my heart. And I have two questions. First of all, how do you engage your volunteers, and how do you motivate them? And this is a very difficult job. And secondly, you said you have a really ambitious goal, and to change, actually to secure changing policy and guidelines. What are the next steps to actually to reach this goal? Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe we can take both the questions and then...
Good morning. My name is Lego. I'm from South Africa, and I am from an organization known as TB Free that augments government TB control programs, and I'm more on the ACSM side of the organization. And what I just wanted to share, I've got one comment and one question for to share with you. The comment is that we found that when developing IEC material like your flyers and the like, especially in a country of, like ours where there are literacy challenges, you would find those flyers scattered all over the streets because people find it difficult to read. At some point it becomes boring and whatnot. And then we introduced measures where we started branding taxis and, you know, printed messages on everyday things that people use so that at least that message stays with them and it's at a place where they are, basically, instead of going out of their way to find a flyer at a clinic, because we found that they throw that away and the expense involved, it was just not worth it, though there are obviously IEC materials that are still being developed. And then my question is, again, in a country such as ours, we are faced with a poverty challenge. And for people that are on TB treatment, there are disability grants that are sometimes given
by government for the duration for which the people are still on treatment? And how do you then get such people involved within the advocacy and social mobilization activities for them to take action in the fight against TB for themselves and for the communities that they live within, when you would have people that intentionally default from treatment in order to continue having that social disability grant?
So I should be first. Thank you, Svetlana, is that correct, for the question and for keeping Georgia close to your heart. Well, actually, the project was not voluntarily based, and it was funded from Open Society Institute Public Health Watch program, meaning that there was a certain amount of grant money for supporting our monitoring and advocacy activities. But still, beyond these things, it needed a lot of work from us and a lot of work from the project staff, and not only from us, and organizing all these events and going to the interviews. But, well, it was not merely voluntarily based. As regards for the next steps, well, true, it is very ambitious advocacy target for restriction of tuberculosis first-line drugs, but it is possible to happen, and good rationale for this gives us the support which we gained, and the raised understanding of the problem of this issue. And probably we would go more ambitious, and probably we would go and advocate for restriction of prescription-free antibiotics, all antibiotics, so which are not only for TB antibiotics, but the next step probably will be for other antibiotics. However, it is a very difficult task, because many parties are included there, and above the levels, like pharmaceutical companies, which are playing a really great role nowadays in Georgian healthcare system, and they get huge profit of selling prescription-free antibiotics. But it is a problem for us, and drug resistance is a problem, and especially for TB. And, the next step will be advocating for having prescriptions for antibiotics in Georgia.
I think I'll sort of comment on the IEC materials. We also have those challenges. So that's why I think in my presentation, I did mention that for us, what we do now is we don't just like go to the community and just give out the flyers or the brochures. We give them out after we have a focus group discussions, or when our members go and do the door-to-door sensitization, they speak to the members or whoever they find in the family and then give out the flyers. With the posters, what we do is we develop these very bright posters, which we put in strategic places. And on those posters, there was a contact address to say, if you want more information, contact this address. They'll come to our secretariat. Then we'll speak to them, and then if they want the brochures, then we give them that information. Because the other reason why we insisted on focus group discussion is that there's this issue about translation. We did find that most of the time, if a person that cannot read English, they cannot even read their mother language, their mother tongue. So that's why we normally have the focus group discussion, speak to them, and then if they need the materials to take to their communities, then we give them the materials. And then on the grants, we do not have those grants in Zambia, so for me it's a bit difficult for me to comment on that. Maybe my other colleagues could take that on.
Okay. Let me just talk about the IEC materials as well. I feel the same way with the TB materials, but I think it's a general human attitude. I think if I'm walking down the street and you give me an IEC material that doesn't really concern me, I probably will throw it in the trash can. But I think it's important to also be innovative in the way you're doing your messaging, and I think that your idea about, you know, pasting it on taxes is great. But maybe the other thing to do is also look at what kind of mediums do people listen to the most, you know. So maybe you want to, like, have a radio program, probably a radio drama on community radio that's talking about TB and what needs to be done and where people can access care. Probably just the basic information that TB is curable, treatment is free, and treatment is accessible, you know, here. Where or here. But I also think that depending on the audiences, the medium of, you know, your communicating is really different. I remember that we had a roundtable discussion and somebody said a TB poster saved my life because he never knew that TB was curable until he saw a poster in a health facility. He was actually thought he was going to die. You know, so I think it's very important to understand your audience and what they listen to the most. Maybe it might be best to, if people watch like soap, Mexican soaps a lot in your country, like they do in Nigeria, you might want to insert one in between, you know, the interlude between the Mexican soap, you know, so you just need to think about what's the best way. That's a dicey situation regarding the fact that people get grants and all of that. I think maybe the thing to do is also to engage with people who have been there, you know, people who have come out of that system, who were cured, who can also, like, talk to their peers. Because the truth of the matter is you never know how it feels unless you're in those shoes. You know, so probably getting a TB champion or somebody who can help people realize that, look, I've come out of this situation. I was in desperation at this time, but now I'm cured of TB. I have a job. I'm doing this well. Those kind of pictures will help motivate people, because I guess maybe their belief is that, okay, if I don't get this, you know, if I don't continue with this, I probably will not get any other means of livelihood. But if there's experience of people who are living their life, who've been cured of TB, who are in that very same situation, who are living life, who are, you know, have a great job, have a family, who can talk to these people and actually mobilize them, maybe that might inspire them to think differently. Just one idea. I don't have all the answers.
Just before, you know, because, of course, I live in New York, and so it's not the same situation. But I was working in Harlem Hospital, which has one of the lowest rates of life expectancy in the developed world. And we were working on a TB project, on TBDOT project. But the way we had constructed the DOT project was that there was always food there, so that whenever people dropped by at whatever time, there was food there. So some basic needs were met. And we also had a commitment to finding public housing, as well as had connected them with continuing education to get their high school level diploma. So one thing for us as healthcare providers is to also understand that health will not be the primary priority for people who are dealing with other life situations. And so how can we either bridge their access to those services in a way that helps them see that we are actually invested in a holistic sense of health and not just a pill that can cure TB. And I think that was really reflected in when we did a survey from our community members, and the treatment completion rate was incredibly high, close to 95%. And we asked them, you know, what do you think of when you come to the DOT clinic? Nobody actually talked about TB. They said, we think about persons who will take care of us. We think of places to come to with our problems. We think of places to come to for our methadone maintenance and our HIV drugs and access to education. And so it was really humbling in some ways to think, oh, my God, we're being funded to TB, to do TB work, but they aren't even thinking about TB when they come here. But in some ways, it reflected in treatment completion in pretty difficult circumstances where the co-infection around TB, HIV was really high and the rates of drug use were really high. So I think it's possible, if you can think about it from the perspective of the user, as to what are their priorities and how can we as service providers link our services or have one-stop shop where people can come in and have their other priorities met along with TB. It can help in treatment adherence. And so I know that there's a question back there, and then Cindy.
Yes, good morning. Thank you to the presenters for all their useful presentations. I've got two questions, one to Tamari and the other one to Carol. I just want to find out the rationale for choosing the advocacy on the irrational drug use, when you, in your assessment, you said that there was some issues to do with health reforms, because I feel trying to advocate also for probably improved health system would also have an effect on the irrational drug use. And then question two, Carol, is that what is your collaboration, your organization's collaboration and engagement with the National TB Control Program, the National AIDS Council, other NGOs and CBOs involved in TB or TB-HIV activities, especially on the issues that you have mentioned in your presentation concerning advocacy, community mobilization, and community sensitization?
Cindy?
Thank you. My name is Cindy Kelemi, and I'm from Bonela, the Botswana Network on Ethics, Law, and HIV/AIDS. I don't know whether I'll categorize mine as a question or a comment, but it can also serve as both. I have a comment about how, because what I've noticed at this conference is that it is clear that there is low activism, especially in TB. My comment is about how do we then, in terms of moving forward, create a platform where, as activists, we can share experiences and begin to build that momentum on TB issues. Because I see that on HIV/AIDS, we have listservs, we have different forms of communication that actually helps us to even continue at country level doing our work and sharing our work with other colleagues from different countries, and also understand the trends globally and regionally about what is happening with regard to TB. But as I'm doing TB work at country level, I don't see a lot of that. It's one or two emails from one or two people. But in terms of continued support and continued rollout of information, that is not available. So my question to everyone, actually, like, how do we then move forward in terms of building momentum and keeping the fire burning, so that, because we are all aware that activism can be sometimes very draining in terms of emotionally and physically, more so that we are people living with these diseases. How do we move forward helping
Thanks,
each other
Cindy.
In that?
Yes?
Yeah, my question is a bit similar to the previous speaker, but I'm Joost van der Meer. I'm from AIDS Foundation East West, also known as AFU, working in Eastern Europe and Central Asia on HIV, but also HIV-TB. And therefore, my question is a bit more directed like Tamari, but I would value the comments of other panelists as well. What I observe, indeed, is it is extremely difficult to engage people living with HIV in activism about TB and HIV. So I don't know whether you experience the same in Georgia and how you overcame those barriers. And because I see a lot, people are somehow easier to engage in activism about harm reduction or hepatitis C, and HIV-TB somehow is not sexy enough, or I don't know what it is. So I would like to hear from you, is it in Georgia the same, and also the other panelists' views on that.
Thanks. Oba?
Thank you. My name is Oba Tunde Oladapo. I want to congratulate the organizers of this session for putting together such a wonderful team of presenters, people that are able to showcase the things they are doing at their different levels. I just want to pass two comments. First, on the issue of IEC. The definition of IEC is quite wide, and we should understand that IEC, the objective of IEC is information to inform, to educate, and communicate whatever messages we want to put across. And in doing this, we also need to understand the importance of a target audience in developing the materials. A lot of us sit down in our offices and ask maybe a designer or whatever to write to produce beautiful posters and other materials, rather than working with the communities to determine what will be appropriate, the language, the medium, the strategies that will be that would achieve the best impacts. And that is the problem with most of our IEC materials. We waste a lot of money on IEC because we don't design appropriate materials. So what we do in our organization in Nigeria is that we make it part of a community assessment that we do. And it is the community members themselves that design the materials which we now produce. And our experience is that when you engage communities to design the materials, it becomes more acceptable. And in many situations, you discover that you have very soon have them in short supply, not because they are throwing them away, but because people are using them. The other issue is just maybe a comment or a call that we need to have an organized, concerted, global coalition of TB activists for us to be able to make a difference in like we did in the HIV world. And I think the time to do that is yesterday. So the next best time to do that is now. I think we should start putting our heads together to start responding more effectively, because we have the best environment amongst the research community, the global community for us that is quite receptive for such a movement now. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. So recognizing that we have about 5 minutes left to stay on time, maybe as you respond to the question, because some of the questions were broad-based, you can also include any last comments that you have.
Regarding, I would like just to touch on the aspect of how to keep the fire burning or the interest on that. Honestly, although I have had TB twice, and there are some experiences like in Peru, which a TB organization, people affected by TB, which has almost 40 years, and another one in Norway, which is more or less the same. These are exceptions, because it's very hard for you to build a identity of with people living with a curable disease. I mean, it's like having any other bacterial infection, and then you don't create any relation to this unless you live with that for the rest of your life, or that affects you tremendously. So I'm not saying that TB does not affect, that TB can kill you, but the fact is that you have to create an identity with the disease. You have to incorporate that. But I would say that there is no formula. But the thing is that we have to see in each and every environment what actually draws people, make people act. In my country, for example, it's very clear there is a tradition of patients' participation in the health system and in the health policies. So patients' participation is required. It's by law, and so there are spaces in so-called the health committees, which is in the districtal level, so I mean areas of town, and then the city committee and the state committee and the national committee. That will define laws and that will define budget. So there are seats for community members to be there. And this brings a lot of political interest. So people tend to participate because there will be a space for TB. So, for example, this is one, that's what I used in Brazil that worked well. I mean, the TB Forum of TB NGOs has over 80 participants in the state of Rio. And I started that from ground zero, and that works well, and without a penny in terms of, I mean, people go there voluntarily, and there is a lot of work going on with very low or any funding. But every country has to find the way. But definitely another strategy is to tackle that the issue of TB, putting TB high in the agenda among the vulnerable populations. I mean, people, especially, obviously, the focus has to be HIV people because they're the most affected and most of people with AIDS die of TB. Organizations dealing with prison population, street population, and other vulnerable populations will make a good job on that. Thank you.
Thanks. If people can be mindful of the time so that we can actually end at 11:15, that'd be great.
Yeah. First, I would reflect on the activism regarding the TB HIV issues in Georgia. Well, activism in general is a very new thing for Georgia, maybe due to our Soviet past and due to our long history of being closed society, where the government decided everything for us and civil society participation was not at all needed, and we didn't participate in anything. And it's like a mentality of people who needs to be changed. I agree, it is a very difficult issue to advocate for something and to be active and to have your civil to understand that your participation is needed. And it's not the problem only from the government who neglects the civil society as it, but also from civil society, because they don't see their meaningful involvement also in the processes, and especially in the things related to healthcare issues. Like, as you said, they have a history and tradition of patients being involved, but we don't have it in Georgia. And in non-Soviet countries, the system was like this, that we didn't participate before, and patients was obedient to the doctor, and in TB particularly. It's difficult, and difficult for us, and it's going under the transition, and we are trying to change it, and we are trying to engage civil society as much as possible. And as regards of tackling the problem of healthcare reform rather than prescription-free availability of the TB first-line drugs, it is a very complex issue. It's over the 15 years when our healthcare reform is undergoing permanent reforms, and we are trying to move towards insurance-based healthcare system, and it is very difficult for our government to decide who is going to pay for the poor population and who is going to pay for the people who is unemployed. So it's a difficult issue, and for us to advocate in that direction, and also bearing in mind that the project was about TB and HIV co-infection, and about the specific policy of WHO, we decided to advocate for this issue. But I would say that our organization is advocacy organization, and we have other donors, and we have other projects also going on, and our projects are on other projects are on improvement of maternal and child health, and to keep government transparent, and to keep the healthcare budget transparent. So we are trying to tackle these issues from different perspectives and different projects.
Thank you, Tamari. So if people have said what you wanted to say before, you might not want to repeat it. And,
no, I'm just answering.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
I'll just answer the direct question to me on the collaboration with the NTPs and the National AIDS Council. I think, like Tamari says, for Zambia, HIV activism is also fairly new, and most of the time activists are viewed as troublemakers. So engaging with the NTP in the beginning was a bit of a problem, but like I mentioned in my presentation, when we had a stakeholders meeting, we did invite the NTP people from the NTP program as well as the National AIDS Council. We knew that if we invited them as talk, they wouldn't come, so we involved National AIDS Council, who invited them to come to the meeting. We invited the people from the communities. And then at this point, when with other organizations, actually TAU at the moment is housing the sort of the task force of all the organizations that work around TB and HIV. When we had our meetings and our trainings, like I said, we invited leaders of support group and community-based organizations working around TB and HIV. So we have an umbrella body in Zambia for support groups of people living with HIV and AIDS. There's also an umbrella body of COPTAG of TB organizations. There's now an umbrella body of support groups of people co-infected. So we have what we call a task force, and these people actually meet at TALC. So there is that collaboration. And when I go back, actually, when I was coming here, I did meet our NTP manager. We had talks, and when we go back, we'll have more collaboration. So we are working at that level as well.
Thanks, Carol.
Okay, I just wanted to respond to Cindy's
Cindy's comment about, you know, networking and burnout. And I think, well, there's no one answer, but one of the things, one of the platforms that I have found useful is the TBHIV listserv, because there are a lot of people on that. There are a lot of community activists on that. And maybe I'll suggest that you get the details from Javed at the end of that. But I also think it's important for us to begin to use the spaces that the HIV activists have also used. So, for instance, the ITPC listserv and all of that, it's important that we also begin to use that to push our TB-HIV issues. So if there's something happening in Botswana and you want people to rally around you and to support you, use those spaces as well. I also think that it's important for us to creatively together think about the people who are on the working groups, you know, and linking up with them to say, you are our representatives on this group, so we have this challenge. You know, what can I do? Advise me on this. Who can I link up with? And also platforms like the international conferences. I know for the first time in a long time, at least the Mexico conference had more sessions on, you know, TB-HIV than previous conferences had. And ICASA is also coming up in Africa in December. These are spaces and platforms that we can use to collectively meet together and discuss and strategize on the way forward. But I truly agree with you that we need to network better, and we need to do that quickly.
Thanks. I'll be brief. Just to build on that, I think the recent linking of HDNet, probably the best listserv organizer in TB, has joined forces with the HIV Alliance, and we're already seeing a dramatic improvement and frequency of very interesting debates around TB and HIV through that collaboration, and I think that's something to build on. I also heard yesterday about ghdonline.org, which is another more technical listserv about issues such as TB infection control, and that's managed by Harvard, I think. I can give anybody who's interested the email addresses if they want. And building on what Olaide said about forthcoming opportunities, there are quite a number of very important advocacy opportunities coming up where we can mimic the sort of TB activism that we saw at the Union Conference in Cape Town last year, the first time there's been a big civil society demonstration at a TB conference. Unfortunately, there hasn't been much here, but the next one is going to be in Mexico, in Cancun, and I think we need to work with our partners in Latin America to build some activism around that conference. There's also the ICASA, as Olaide mentioned, in December. Some of you may or may not be aware that WHO, with a number of partners, is coordinating a very high-level ministerial meeting on drug-resistant TB in Beijing in April. We fought quite hard to get TB-HIV or HIV and drug-resistant TB on the agenda, and it keeps slipping off. So I think we need a lot of activism from civil society to make sure that the threat of drug-resistant TB, particularly to people living with HIV, is high on that agenda. And finally, there's the HIV pathogenesis meeting. This is the slightly more scientific of the international AIDS conferences, which is in Cape Town next year. And again, we saw in Mexico that for the first time ever, a TB demonstration at the World AIDS Conference, people living with HIV yet dying of TB is unacceptable. And that sort of activism, I think we need to aim at the Cape Town meeting. So we need to get on to our colleagues at Treatment Action Campaign and really start to build the research community's interest in TB, new drugs, diagnostics, and vaccines, particularly compatible for people living with HIV.
Thanks, Alistair. Just
2 seconds.
Okay. The one thing, as Colleen comes on board, okay, go ahead, Colleen.
Okay, I just wanted to mention two or three other things. I really encourage all of you to join the Stop TB Partnership TB-HIV Working Group, because one of the things that we're trying to do in the coming year, well, in the next few weeks, actually, is to try and get a dialogue going between members. So I really encourage you to join that group. two other important meetings next, three other ones next year, Stop TV Partnership Forum in March, where we might have an opportunity to have a civil society symposium where we can further discuss how we work together and collaborate. At the Cape Town meeting on AIDS, there'll be a research, TB-HIV research priorities meeting, which I really encourage people to try and attend. And then finally, the TB-HIV working group will have a meeting, sort of an annual meeting that's not held annually, in Asia and the Pacific next year in August, attached to the ICAP, the International AIDS Society meeting on AIDS in Asia and the Pacific. So I encourage you to start discussions about being involved in those as well.
Thanks a lot. No, can't take any more. Just give a round of applause to all the speakers, and thanks for coming.